The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program, The Reluctant Deliverer, is the last in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book. Mr. Samuel.
This evening, the services of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the most solemn day in the Jewish calendar, begin. In the traditional services, the Book of Jonah is read out as a very appropriate reminder that repentance for one's evil deeds brings salvation to man. For the Book of Jonah, which, like the Book of Ruth, is one of the shortest in the Bible, tells how a city of idol worshippers, Nineveh, the great, the illustrious, repented of its evil ways and was saved from destruction. One of the interesting points is that the Ninevites are not mentioned as having become converted to Judaism. They simply reformed after hearing Jonah, and their destruction was averted. This is the straightforward message of the book. But there are many facets to it, carrying other messages. Let us go to the record. We read, Now the word of the Lord came unto Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord, and went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish, and he paid the fare, and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. At once we are pulled up. How was it possible for Jonah, a prophet, to imagine that he could flee anywhere from the presence of God? And we must suppose that in that moment Jonah lost his prophetic insight. He didn't want to go to Nineveh. And when there is something the man wants too passionately to do or not to do, his intelligence gives way, even if he is a prophet. But why didn't Jonah want to go to Nineveh? Paradoxically enough, because he was a true prophet and a servant of God. He was a true and proficient prophet. He was also gifted with the power to convince people that he foresaw the future. Please notice that distinction. The characteristic of the Hebrew prophets was not that they could foresee the future. Their characteristic and function was to carry God's message to people. But in the case of Jonah, the desire to prove that he could foresee the future infallibly was stronger than his desire to carry God's message. He was in a dilemma. On the one hand, he was bidden to announce to the Ninevites, Within 40 days, Nineveh will be destroyed. On the other hand, he knew that if they took him seriously, they would repent and reform, and his prophecy would then be falsified, and he would be made to look ridiculous. That was how Jonah justified his flight from God. When, as it turned out, the Ninevites did listen to him and reform and were saved from destruction, Jonah complained bitterly to God in these words, Was not this my saying when I was yet in my own country? Therefore I fled from thee to Tarshish, for I know thou art a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness, and repentest thee of the evil. But let's go back to the early development of the story. Jonah is on the ship carrying him to Tarshish, and we read, The Lord sent out a great wind into the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that it looked as if the ship were about to break. And the sailors were afraid, and each one cried to his God. And they threw out the freight that they carried into the sea to make the ship lighter. But Jonah had gone down into the hold, and he lay there fast asleep. Again, let's stop to consider what the narrator is trying to convey to us. A ship, tempest-tossed, death in the air, the sailors despairing and crying to their gods, and one man, a passenger, sleeping in the hold. The strange thing is that he was not forgotten in the midst of the panic. No, we read, The captain of the ship went down to Jonah and said to him, What dost thou mean that thou sleepest? Arise, call upon thy God, if so be that God will think upon us that we perish not. All sorts of reflections are thrust upon us at this point. Did the captain of the ship go down to Jonah out of concern for his passenger? Or did he think, here we've all been crying to our various gods to calm the sea, and we've had no success. Perhaps this peculiar passenger, we don't hear of any other passengers, knows of a God that can save us and has some influence with that God. The sailors and the captain obviously belonged to a world in which people weren't very choosy about their gods. They perhaps varied their worship with their geography or with the element they were addressing, a god of the sea, of the land, of the hills, of the valleys, of the north, of the south. We are inclined to think of them as primitive and superstitious, and yet, as we shall see in a moment, they were decent and honorable, and the narrator of the book of Jonah treats them with respect. We read, And they said to each other, Let us cast lots, so that we may know who is the cause of the evil that has come upon us. So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, Tell us, we pray thee, for what cause this evil hath come upon us. What is thy occupation, and whence comest thou? What is thy country, and of what people art thou? And he said to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to Jonah, What is it that thou hast done? For the men knew they had fled from the presence of the Lord, because he had told them. Then they said to him, What shall we do to thee that the sea may become calm? And he said to them, Take me up and cast me into the sea, so that the sea may become calm. For I know that this great tempest has come upon you because of me. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to bring the ship to the land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they cried unto the Lord and said, We beseech thee, O Lord, we beseech thee, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not upon us innocent blood, for thou, O Lord, hast done as it pleased thee. So they took up Jonah and cast him forth into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered up a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. How badly Jonah shows up at this point as compared with the heathen sailors. They knew and he knew that he was the cause of the tempest. But he did not jump into the sea. He hadn't faith enough, which is understandable even in a prophet who is fleeing from the presence of the Lord, which means, in effect, that he is denying God. Still, he wouldn't commit the sin of suicide. He wanted the sailors to commit the sin of murder, or at least of being his executioners. They were reluctant to assume that role. They prayed to be forgiven for assuming it. And only after they had prayed did they take up Jonah and cast him into the sea. Heathens, idolaters, superstition-ridden, they were men with sensitive consciences. Only as a last desperate resort did they take Jonah at his word. The narrative continues, The Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. And Jonah prayed to the Lord out of the fish's belly. It is a pity that the picturesqueness of this part of the story has obscured in the popular imagination what I take to be its innermost meaning. Jonah had tried to flee from the presence of God. He should have known, as a matter of fact, he did know, but deliberately suppressed the knowledge in himself that there was no fleeing from God. Whether or not he was acquainted with the words of the psalmist, he too could have asked, Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in the netherworld, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thy hand would lead me. And indeed, when he was in the belly of the fish, he prayed in these words, Out of the belly of the netherworld I cried, and thou didst hear my voice. Now that doesn't sound right. You would expect him to say, Out of the belly of the fish do I cry. and that past tense has caused a lot of speculation. The old legends say that while he was in the belly of the fish, Jonah didn't pray at all. He was so comfortable there that he had no desire to change his condition. The legends embroider the biblical story with many details. The fish was so big that one could have constructed a large synagogue in it. The eyes of the fish served Jonah as windows. More than that, say the legends, the fish was so obliging that it took Jonah on a kind of tour and showed him the spot at which the Israelites crossed the Red Sea and the river from which the ocean flows and other historical sites. It was a kind of submarine tour, and this time Jonah had not paid any fare as he had done for his voyage on the ship. Are these legends just playful embroideries? I think not. Every generation of Jews invents new legends and interpretations of the stories of the Bible. I think these legends are trying to tell us that Jonah was, in spite of his prayers, thoroughly happy to be where he was, however uncomfortable it might be, just so long as he had escaped from his duty as a prophet. On the ordinary level of human experience, we see men putting in far more work and inventiveness to dodge an obligation than they would need to honor the obligation. The predominant obsession with Jonah was, I don't want to go to Nineveh. I don't want to save that city and lose my reputation as a foreseer of the future. And compared with that hateful prospect, anything he had to endure was a comfort. And the fact is that Jonah did ultimately become known as the false prophet. We find that name given to him in another part of the legends. But the reason I would give for that interpretation would not be the same as theirs. But let us return to the narrative. At the end of 3 days, the fish was commanded to spew out Jonah onto the dry land, which it did. And apparently Jonah thought he was through with that miserable problem. He'd got out of it one way or another. But he was mistaken, for we read, and the word of the Lord came unto Jonah the second time. Arise, go unto Nineveh, that great city, and make unto it the proclamation that I bid thee. It is possible, though we aren't told so, that Jonah again thought of fleeing from the presence of the Lord. But what was the use? He would be spending his life in flight. The interior of that fish may not have been as comfortable as some of the legends say. It was only Jonah's imagination that made it seem so. But who could tell what kind of accommodations would await him on a second and third and fourth flight? This much must be said for Jonah. One lesson was enough to teach him that a man cannot escape from God or from the destiny which lies in his own character. For we must remember that Jonah was by destiny or by character a prophet. Some of the legends say that he was a pupil of the great Elisha, who had inherited the mantle of Elijah. So we read, Jonah arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceeding great city of 3 days' journey. Whether this means that it took 3 days to cross the city or to walk round the city was an immense metropolis. But it seems to me in the first, for we read, Jonah began to enter the city a day's journey, and he proclaimed and said, Yet 40 days, and Nineveh shall be overthrown. He didn't begin on the outskirts. He got into the heart of the city, and there he delivered himself of the message, not to anyone in particular, but to the population at large. Yet 40 days, and Nineveh shall be overthrown. Then we read further, And the people of Nineveh believed God, and they proclaimed a fast, and put on sackcloth from the greatest of them to the least of them, and the tidings reached the king of Nineveh. The tidings reached the king of Nineveh. Much is revealed in this simple phrase. The king was separated from the people. He lived in isolated majesty. High and low had proclaimed the fast, and the tidings had to reach the king. But when they reached him, the effect on him was overwhelming, for we read further, And the king arose from his throne, and laid his robe from him, and covered himself with sackcloth, and published through Nineveh by the decree of the king and his nobles, let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock taste anything. Let them not feed or drink water, but let them be covered with sackcloth, both man and beast, and let them cry mightily to God. Let them turn every one from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. Consider that passage with its curious implications. It was the people that set the moral revolution in motion. And the revolution was so powerful that the king could not resist it. I like to think of this passage as indicating that a people cannot blame its leaders for the evil it commits. The people has the power to disobey its leaders. The plea, "I was commanded to do this or that evil thing, and therefore I am not to blame," has an important relevance for our time. We've heard that plea recently in connection with a famous trial that took place in Israel. The plea has no validity, and this part of the book of Jonah makes that clear. The people of Nineveh repented, and the king, not to lose his throne, followed suit. And of course, he outdid the people in his protestations of remorse. He issued the command that everyone must wear sackcloth and sit in ashes and fast. It was a superfluous command because that was what everyone was doing. He went further than necessary just to show that he was king and commanded that the innocent beasts should also be deprived of food and water. How long did this go on? A day? 2 days? 10? We don't know. But it can't have been too long. It surely can't have been 40 days, or the inhabitants of Nineveh would have perished together with their cattle. We read, "And God saw their works, that they had turned from their evil way, and he repented of the evil which he said he would do to them, and he did not do it." Well, then we are left with a puzzle. If God withheld his forgiveness for 40 days, the Ninevites, or such of them as still remained alive, could not be sure till the last day that Jonah's prophecy of doom would remain unfulfilled. We are driven to the conclusion that God did not wait 40 days and that he indicated his forgiveness well before that period had elapsed. By what means did he do it? We are not told. It was there, and we can imagine the relief and gratitude that swept through the city, the reprieval, another chance to live and to live decently, the universal resolution that sprang from the gratitude, the never again of human beings who have looked death in the face and have realized that they merited death and are determined never to merit it again. And amidst this gratitude, amidst these high resolves, there was one man whose heart was bitter, whose countenance was sour. For we read, "It displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry." He foresaw now, and obviously before the end of the 40 days, that Nineveh was not going to be destroyed. It was at this moment that he said to God reproachfully, "Therefore I fled beforehand to Tarshish, for I know thou art a gracious God and compassionate, long-suffering and abundant in mercy, and repentest thee of the evil." What a frightful attitude for a prophet. And how violently he resented his predicament, we judge from the following. "Therefore, O Lord, take, I beseech thee, my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live." And the Lord said, "Art thou greatly angry?" God's question is sad, ironical, compassionate. "Art thou greatly angry?" There is worse to come. Jonah still seemed to hope against hope that something would happen to save his reputation as a foreseer of the future. We read, "Then Jonah went out of the city and made him there a booth and sat under it in the shadow till he might see what would become of the city. And the Lord prepared a gourd," that is a variety of fast-growing tree, "and made it to come up over Jonah that it might be a shadow over his head. So Jonah was exceedingly glad because of the gourd. But God prepared a worm when the morning rose next day, and it smote the gourd that it withered, And when the sun arose, God prepared a vehement east wind. And the sun beat upon the head of Jonah, that he fainted, and he asked that he might die, and said, "It is better for me to die than to live." And God said to Jonah, "Art thou greatly angry for the gourd?" And Jonah answered, "I am greatly angry, even unto death." And the Lord said, "Thou hast had pity on the gourd, for which thou hast not labored, nor made it grow, which came up in a single night and perished in night. And should I not have pity on Nineveh, that great city wherein are more than 120,000 that cannot tell their right hand from their left, and also much cattle?" That is how the book of Jonah ends. It does not tell us what happened to Jonah afterwards. It tells us that Nineveh was saved with its 120,000 infants, those that couldn't yet tell their right hand from their left. They and their parents and grandparents and the cattle too. One of my teachers, the great Hebrew poet Chaim Nachman Bialik, interpreted the book of Jonah as a protest against the furious denunciations of the prophets in general against the people. I don't know whether that interpretation was his own or is to be found somewhere in the tradition, but it is illuminating. Bialik said, "It was easy for the prophets, with their peculiar ascetic temperaments, to denounce the life of the cities. Sometimes these prophets came up from the primitive country places or from the desert, and they couldn't bear the sight of luxury or even of ordinary comfort. And even a prophet born into the aristocracy, Isaiah, was intolerant of the graces of city life." It was understandable, said Bialik, that Isaiah should denounce those daughters of Jerusalem who abused luxury. "Because the daughters of Zion are haughty," thundered Isaiah, "and walk with stretched out necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet. Therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. The Lord will take away the bravery of their anklets and the fillets and the crescents, the pendants and the bracelets and the veils, the rings and the jewels. Instead of sweet spices, there shall be rottenness, and instead of a girdle, rags." That was understandable, said Bialik, or rather would have been understandable if Isaiah had added, "Anklets and fillets and pendants and bracelets and sweet spices are part of civilization, but they mustn't be turned into the be-all and the end-all of a woman's life." But Isaiah didn't add that modification, even though we read in the Bible of a bride being adorned and of the beauty that should be attendant upon certain rituals. He did not add that modification. And it was as a protest against Isaiah's grim severity, the grim severity of other prophets, that, according to Bialik, the book of Jonah was written. But after these reflections, I must turn back to the central purpose of the book of Jonah, which is clarified in the Day of Atonement services by a brief reading from another prophet, Micah. "Who is a God like unto thee that pardons iniquity and passes by the transgression of the remnants of his heritage and retains not his anger forever because he delights in mercy?" I quote this to emphasize that central interpretation of the book of Jonah, but not to invalidate other supplementary interpretations. During the broadcasts on the Bible, which Mark Van Doren and I have been making for the last 10 summers, I have occasionally received letters of protest. Some listeners think that we read too much into the text. We build mountains of interpretation on molehills of text. My answer has always been, The Bible is the most condensed book of any in existence. It is at once an anthology and an abridgment. It refers often to books which have been lost, books which were in existence when the Bible was canonized, and the reader is referred to them. Is it not written in the book of Jasher? Is it not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? In the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? The Bible was meant to be read alongside of those books, and those books no longer exist. So in their absence, we have been encouraged from of old to add our own speculations, and if we scrutinize the text, we do in fact discover deeper and deeper layers of meaning. There are certain books that we ought to read again and again, and among them, the Bible is preeminent. Perhaps I ought not even to speak of the Bible as a book if it places it merely in the rank of literature. There are in the Bible sentences which are like those tiny Japanese blossoms that you throw into a basin of water and you see them expand and unfold into labyrinthine flowers. I have been reading the Bible for nearly 50 years, and I still draw fresh meanings from passages which are as familiar to me as my own hands. Sometimes these meanings are contradictory, but that is of no consequence. For in a great work, as in a great man, contradictions don't cancel out, they add up. It is true that the richest rewards come from reading the Bible in the original Hebrew. And even if you know only the Hebrew alphabet, you get more by following the Hebrew text side by side with a good translation, or better still, with two or three scholarly translations. And this, by the way, is as good a method of learning Hebrew as any other. But in all our broadcasts, Mark Van Doren and I have used only English translations. And from these translations alone, we have derived an endless variety of interesting interpretations. At any rate, interesting to us. At this evening's and tomorrow's services, we shall be expressing contrition for our misbehavior in the past and making pledges of better behavior in the future. Among these pledges, an important one would be to make Bible reading a regular habit throughout the year.
Just heard the last in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book, published by Alfred A. Knopf, Incorporated. The Eternal Light would welcome any comments you have concerning this series with Maurice Samuel. Write to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. Due to the holiday of Sukkot, the Biblical Festival of Thanksgiving, and Simchat Torah, the Rejoicing of the Law, the Eternal Light will not be heard for the next 2 weeks. Be with us 3 weeks from today, when the Eternal Light resumes its regular dramatic series, with the first of four programs entitled Freedom and Responsibility. The Eternal Light is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.